Making Good. I'm Renee Blanchard, founder and operator of Church Alley Cafe and Grocery, located here in New Orleans, Louisiana. Church Alley is a people-first, mission-driven small business that I opened in 2013. And the best part about owning a cafe is the people. So in this podcast, I interview the makers, the farmers, and the many interesting people I've met through the shops, the folks doing the good work here in Louisiana and all along the Gulf Coast. Let's get started.
Hi, my name is Anjali Prazer-Tong, and I'm a public health dietitian. And I have worked in healthy corner store programs. I ran one in New Orleans. I have my Master of Public Health from Tulane and worked for an organization in New Orleans called Propeller, where I helped food entrepreneurs sort of operationalize racial equity in their businesses. And I lived in New Orleans for 7 years and now live in Denver. And I run, I write for the Substack newsletter, Anti-Racist Dietitian.
Well, thank you so much for being here. I really appreciate your time talking to me.
Great to be here.
Yeah, so we met through my shop or connected through my shop when you were in New Orleans. And I've reached out. And I know customers know that I am currently on a similar path of getting my dietetics degree and then a master's in public health is what I'm going for as well. So I appreciate your time. And then I wanted to ask you, where did your handle anti-racist dietitian come from? Like, how did you decide that that's kind of what you knew you wanted to be talking about regularly?
Sure. So I sort of had my awakening in, I think it was 2017 when I was a student at Tulane. They offered an undoing racism training for students. And that's a local, like New Orleans-based organization called People's Institute for Their Survival and Beyond. And that was really transformative for me, just realizing that dietetics never talked about racism. You know, in the training, we talked about all the different institutions that sort of upheld white supremacy and how that plays out in the world. And I realized why I had enjoyed studying public health so much was that they did openly talk about racism and its connection to nutrition and health, and that I'd really never heard anyone in my dietetics classes talk about that. So it was always something that I was very passionate about. And I from there was sort of inspired to do this project during my last year with the chef Tunde Wei, where he actually he had a pop-up lunch counter and charged white diners 2.5 times more than Black and other BIPOC diners for the same meal. So I did the, and then he kind of talked to people and collected their reactions. Yeah. So I did the data coordination for that. And that,
I didn't realize that. I remember when that happened. I remember.
Yeah. So that really inspired me to just think about like, oh, how can I combine these two things, like racial equity and nutrition and food? So when I finished my dietetic internship with Tulane, I was really, especially after just seeing all the racial health disparities across, especially New Orleans metro area, was just really inspired to make sure that that was at the center of what I did. And at that time, which was 2018, Propeller was one of the few food organizations or food-related organizations in the city that was really talking about that. So start working for them. And then, of course, in the summer of 2020, after the murder of George Floyd, for the first time ever on social media, started seeing dietitians actually talking about racism. Like, this was honestly, first, it was just like, whoa, maybe people are ready to start talking about this, because it really felt up to that point that it was falling on deaf ears. And I really made no attempt to sort of change the profession because it felt sort of fruitless. But at that point, I was like, oh, I can bring something to the table and speak up, and maybe now people will listen. So I created an Instagram handle, Anti-Racist RD, and started posting, making sort of long slideshows about nutrition and racism. And It was really well received, especially at that point in time when a lot of white dietitians and the majority of the field is white dietitians were trying to educate themselves. But it wasn't the right venue. And honestly, my personal life, I had an infant. So I was like, I can't keep making these 12 slide things, yeah. Instagram posts that are trying to distill all this information that really isn't meant to be consumed in this bite-sized forum. And then a few years later, after I'd moved, I was sort of at a crossroads with my career and figuring out what to do after working with Propeller, now that I was in a new city, and really realized that I missed, writing, before becoming a dietitian. I was a food writer and editor for the website, The Kitchen. I just really missed creativity and realized I could come back to writing and kind of bring together all these threads of my experience and education and viewpoint and maybe bring something useful to people. So I decided to relaunch the brand as a Substack newsletter. And Substack, you know, has been getting more popular over the years, and it has a lot of tools that kind of made that a very simple process. So that's how it started. And it's been great. Like, I've had a lot of opportunities to connect with other dietitians and just people who are interested in talking about these issues, but maybe don't feel that they have the experience or sort of training to really talk about them openly.
Yeah. Thank you. I think of you, like, moving to the Substack and reading your pretty much weekly emails on that and post, I like think of you as a journalist now. Like, that's what it kind of feels like, because you tackle issues that are happening, you know, nationally. So some issues, like things that you've seen in the media that, you know, we kind of talked about, and other things are like, oh, this is one very nuanced, you know, road that we're going to go down about one issue. So I really appreciate that, the difference, and then you still share it on Instagram, of like some of the snippets of what you're talking about. So right. I really appreciate like reading really in depth, like long form, about that, whatever issue happens to have come up or topic.
Thank you.
And you're talking about, just to clarify, so the dietetics internship is before you take the national board exam, after you've kind of completed most of your in-classroom training. And then the internship is that you go to clinical settings or community settings for like 9 or 10 months, and you spend a few weeks in multiple different settings. And you did that at Tulane here in New Orleans. And can you talk a little bit, you mentioned it, but can you talk about some of the racial inequities that you saw in that specific timeline, like going to all these different types of settings?
Sure. So, first of all, you know, you living in New Orleans, it's obviously a majority Black city, and often whether you're working in a community setting that's offering, like free food, like food assistance to people, or you're working in a clinical setting where you're seeing people who have conditions like diabetes or end-stage renal failure, often the patients are Black, and the vast majority of dietitians are white. And I actually did not work with any Black dietitians. And so that is a problem, because there's just not as much cultural understanding of foods that are important to people and sort of the conditions of their lives and the barriers that they might face to seeking out medical care and things like that. And we should also note that it really takes a lot of time and money to become a dietitian. And that's part of why the vast majority of dietitians are white. 80% of dietitians are white. And a lot of times they come from more middle or upper class backgrounds because you need to have some sort of support in order to go through an unpaid. It's actually not only an unpaid 9-month internship, you have to pay to do the internship.
That was shocking when I learned.
Yeah. And you have to have a car to get to all of your rotations. And that comes on top of already doing a bachelor's degree. And now starting in 2024, you're also going to have a master's degree. So just all these financial barriers that sort of disadvantage you if you come from, in particular in New Orleans, if you are come from a Black household, which has like just so much less generational wealth than white households do. So that was a problem. And then it was just, you see a lot of just power dynamics play out where, you know, the Black patients are non-compliant and the white doctors or dietitians are telling them sort of what they need to do without checking in to make sure, like, is this going to work for their lives? Like, does this align with their cultural beliefs? And just sort of like a very shamey behind the scenes, you know, as an intern, just closing the door and then being like, oh, I know they're not going to listen to that advice or, yeah. And sometimes just straight up racism, like a white dietitian listening to a message from the wife of a Black, like the Black wife of a patient, and the dietitian telling me like, oh, you get some of these sometimes that think they know what they're talking about. Clearly like saying that it was a, that somehow like a Black person that knows what they're talking about, but they don't. Another preceptor telling, intern whose family was from Central America that she was really excited about Trump building the wall, things like that.
When you say non-compliant, that is like a label that medical professionals put in charts to show whether a patient is willing to take the advice or not. And a lot of times people of color will be labeled non-compliant when there are a range of issues that are happening.
Right. Yeah. Just that choice of language is very, has a lot of power differentials baked in. And then in particular, just seeing, at the dialysis clinic that rotation was very like just affected me tremendously. Because the clinic I went to was in the Bywater, and basically the vast majority of patients were people of color. And dialysis is really sort of the last step in a very long thread of just the ways that our food system fails BIPOC people. And, you know, it's like poor food access and then leading to living in an area affected by food apartheid where you don't have a full service grocery store, you don't have access to fresh foods. And then, you know, that can lead to type 2 diabetes, and then type 2 diabetes can eventually lead to problems with your kidneys. And then here you are and you have to come to the dialysis clinic 2 times a week, and it completely disrupts the rest of your life. And there are a lot of, this isn't like revolutionary. If you look it up, there are so many, like racism is a reason why Black people experience end stage renal disease at far greater rates than white people. So that was just felt like, the internship was really hard, but seeing all these different parts, seeing schools and what school food looks like, seeing these community clinics, seeing these poor kids being trotted through the obesity clinics and sort of the psychological damage that I witnessed there. We even did a rotation up at the mental hospital that's on the North Shore. I can't remember which one it was, but that was like a very intense experience as well. So just seeing all these different ways that food the food system kind of fails people and then how that plays out in their health, while at the same time really not learning in class or in my rotations any of the reasons why these failures were happening or why we were seeing the disproportionate impacts on people of color.
Yeah, it's really interesting. And you have one of the posts that I've read more recent. I read it a while ago, but I reread it recently to prep for this discussion, is called like security versus meal security. Can you talk a little bit about what you mean by that? I mean, some of the thing, I think what you were just talking about is kind of all of those things put together. But when we think of food security, or insecurity versus security, but is we don't have enough food, right? We can't find enough food. But you kind of go into some of the details of why way more complicated than making sure our neighbors have enough food every day.
Right. Because, you know, a lot of efforts focused on sort of getting people that bag of groceries, which is great because that is very much needed. But what are you going to do with a bag of dry rice and a bag of dry beans if you don't have access to clean water or a stove to cook it on? Or if you don't have the knowledge of how to cook, make that into an actual meal. So meal security is really the actual plate of food that you consume. And what I talk about in that post is how a lot of that labor often falls onto the shoulders of women, especially if they're mothers. And that's not really an acknowledged part of it. And I think that could be one reason why we don't think about food in those terms. I just imagine, I mean, even as someone who has to cook for my own kids, I just imagine like, what would it be like if we did have these sources of like fresh, culturally diverse, and affordable or free meals that you could just stop by and pick up for dinner. And I think what we're seeing right now is a lot of shaming around like ultra processed food and like, oh, people don't cook anymore. It's just all about convenience, without acknowledging that like living under capitalism, we're all just struggling to survive. Yeah. And sometimes like what stands between you and nothing is that like microwave meal that you can just pick up and heat without everything else that accompanies it. And I think a lot of times there's just this romanticism of cooking and sort of artisanal ways of living without acknowledging that there's so much labor behind that. And if we don't offer that, find a way to equalize that labor, then it will disproportionately fall onto the shoulders of mothers.
Yeah. Yeah, it was interesting because that's how you kind of introduced this discussion of like, you have two kids now, I think.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I have two kids.
You're like, I am just cooking all the time, every day, all day for so many people. Like, what if I didn't have this, you know, all of these resources or all of this access to do all of these things? What does this look like? And I was interesting, like, just thinking most recently about the saltwater intrusion that we are experiencing in South Louisiana, where a month or two ago, very southern at the very mouth of the Mississippi, and they are still dealing in Plaquemines Parish of not having clean drinking water. It's all salt water right now. And so they're bringing water in, but it had been threatening New Orleans up until about 2 weeks ago when they were able to slow down. And so when I think about this, it's like, one, this is climate change, and South Louisiana and the Gulf Coast sees the first pieces of climate change, of changing climate consistently, that we're always at the forefront of the next thing that's happening on climate. And that's impacting our drinking water and chronic disease. There was a study that came out this summer that showed for every 1 degree increase in annual temperature, there's 100,000 new diabetes cases.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And then last summer, a study came out that showed on the first hot and the first cold day are the most number of cardiac events in the year. And that makes sense. I remember when, I think last year when Buffalo got hit by that snowstorm, they were telling people who had any kind of heart, who even had high blood pressure, to not go outside and to not shovel anything, to not do anything. And that was part of this consistent trend that we see. But talking about the salt road and clean drinking water is that a lot of people use infant formula that needs clean water. And I was reading at the time when this was on the news every day is that every person used about 100 gallons of water a day, like throughout their day, which seems like a lot. I'm not sure, but that is what they were saying, putting it out. But at the same time was the House of Representatives was like going to shut down the government, which means WIC and SNAP programs people were not going to get their benefits. So they wouldn't get their infant formula or their bottled water or the different things, more fresh vegetables that they were able to get. That's kind of also what you're talking about, are these bigger systemic issues that we are facing more often than communities have in the past.
Definitely. And just talking about the end stage liver disease, that is also definitely impacted by the warm, like climate change and hotter temperatures. And, there's a
study. Sorry, you are going to. Okay. If you want to talk about that study, I learned it from you and it was so interesting.
Yeah. So, there's just been a lot going on in, I think on Central American agricultural workers, sugarcane workers, having all these liver problems, and they think it's because of just, rising temperatures. And they've also found it in other areas, like some parts of California and different places in the world. And at the same time, once you have it and once your sort of renal system is failing, you can't really drink a lot of water, in order to cool off. So that was also just really striking to me. Like, I cannot imagine living through an August in New Orleans with no air conditioning and not being allowed to drink more than a very small amount of water over the course of the day. And just how does that impact your life? How do you deal with that? And then also, if you have a sort of health condition like that, living in a place that is struck by natural disasters sort of on a regular basis, that's so terrifying and disruptive as well, because without being able to go to the dialysis center, if there's no bus to take you there because that's shut down because of weather, like, what do you do? So there's so many disruptions to life. And then just thinking about like water and clean and safe water, obviously New Orleans, and other, places like Jackson have, issues with water infrastructure, whether that is lead in the water or boil water advisories, or just, not being able to really trust the water that's coming out of the taps for good reason.
And this also is, these are issues that dietitians need to understand. These are our clients and our patients in clinical settings, but also on one-on-one talking to your neighbor or whatever. I'm not a dietitian yet, but I get asked all the time, just knowing that I'm in school, like, for more information. And so it's something we kind of have. And that's true for every person I've spoken to who is a dietitian or in school, is that you're constantly being asked questions, but we need to know like how to offer advice or offer counseling or education within the scope of where people are living, like, and what do they actually have access to?
The context for sure, which is rarely provided. And I was shocked, actually. I did my pediatric rotation, like working in the NICU, through Tulane, and the dietitian there, I asked her about infant formula and if she told families about the water, and just to make sure that they used some sort of lead filtering water filter. And she just laughed and did and was like, "Oh, that's not a problem here." And I was shocked. But yeah, the power issues with being an intern versus when talking to your preceptor, like it's not, it's very much frowned upon to try to correct your preceptor. So I just didn't say anything.
And a lot, just take a moment to say there's no water problem in New Orleans, in any place in South Louisiana anyway.
Yeah.
I think that also is, that's an interesting, so when people see dietitians in a clinical setting, those positions, and kind of going back into why we're now requiring a graduate degree and a post-baccalaureate, like further education too, is because dietitians are not taken seriously in a lot of those settings to begin with, or nutrition isn't taken that seriously. And so that's one of the reasons. But so we have these structures in place, but even if you weren't the intern, but you were our dietitian, you're not also going to be taken as seriously.
Right.
Talking about that type, you know?
Yeah. I think often, especially in the hospital setting, that's kind of the last, nutrition's like the last thing that they care about.
Yeah.
As far as just the team working with the patient. And it's just a hard, I feel for a lot of hospital dietitians, because it's also not a great setting to even talk to the patients about what's going on with them. It's just a very stressful place to be in, and how much time are you spending with them? And then once they're checked out of the hospital, you probably won't see them again. So it's hard to kind of make those trusting relationships and bring about any sort of behavior change in such a compressed amount of stressful time.
Yeah. And then it's, I'm right. And then those issues are kind of like, well, then you have the structural and systemic issues around nutrition when you get home, and then you have them within a clinical setting as well. And so people are just getting, like, just not being included as they move forward in their health journey and mm-hmm. whatever that is. One thing I also, well, there's a few other things, but one, I wanted to go back to one issue is, when people have these health scares, like, we are kind of looking at social media right now to find information. It's kind of how so what should people be looking for? And when you look at, so I just started doing some, we've opened up some coaching on attached to the coffee shop. And so I'm like looking at branding, like, what are people saying? What does their stuff look like? In that marketing aspect, but also just to see what's happening. And it is like, everything is very specific to one type of person, which is me, which is a white woman in, you know, who cares about her health. Like, that, I am the target market, but that's not really helpful for most of the world, you know, for everyone that needs these kind of conversations. So what can people, and I guess some things that really strike me too is, like, there's a lot of conversation about nutrition where these foods don't work. Don't eat these types of foods. Don't, you know, you need to be doing this type of stuff. And it's for someone that looks like me, not for someone that looks like the rest of my neighborhood or the city, you know? So can you just maybe, how do we flag what is nutritionally more accurate, but also more culturally accurate, to where we can still eat the stuff that we know and love too?
Mm-hmm. This actually just came up with a friend of mine who also runs a Substack. Can I have another snack? She writes about like feeding kids, basically, from an anti-diet perspective. So she was looking at this dietitian online who's really pushing this type of super expensive prenatal supplement that has like a form of folate that's closer, by her claim, like closer to food like the folate you get from food rather than folic acid, which is what is usually in most supplements. So she was just pointing out all the red flags. So first, kind of a funny one, very like inside baseball for nutrition people, is like, if someone is super into Weston A. Price, then he was like a dentist in the 30s. Like people in the sort of like natural food space are like Weston Price. Like he is a genius. So he just was very skeptical of any sort of anything that was like different from a very like whole foods based natural. Anyway, so look him up. If you see someone that is like super into Weston A. Price, that's a red flag. Just because that brings along with it all these certain ideas about like that something quote unquote natural is good. And so in this post, and I can send it to you, Laura does a great sort of explainer of why you don't need to get freaked out about this one specific issue that this social media dietitian is really making the centerpiece of her brand. And also, by the way, she sells supplements. So if you're looking for one, like here it is. So that's another red flag, as someone that's going to make money off of you taking their advice. And I really see it just in reading that. I realize like there's so many dietitians, and I understand because I have my niche, where they're just like, this is just their one thing, like this one thing that they're just going to talk about nonstop. And if you follow them, it starts to feel like, wow, this must be really important because they keep talking about this one issue. But it's the fact is like no one else is really talking about it. That probably means it's not actually that important for your health. It's important for their business bottom line because now they're getting people all whipped up about this one thing that they think is going to make or break their health, and they better buy this thing that's going to solve their problem. So yeah, just kind of asking yourself, and it's hard if I know a lot of people are just like finding information through TikTok and maybe not looking at other sources, but it's worth it to just see, is anyone else talking about this? Like if you Google and put the site :.gov, you can, and then search the search term, you can see if it's showing up on any government websites. Because of course, like there's so many problems, especially with the supplement world and how little of that is being sort of monitored. But if there is some sort of like widespread problem with the folic acid in the prenatal supplements that have been available for decades, like someone else is going to be talking besides this person on social media. And then as far as like finding more culturally relevant information, I think just try to seek out dietitians that reflect your race and ethnicity and culture. There are a lot more. I mean, that's the great thing about social media, is that you don't have to find these people through any sort of gatekeeper. You can just kind of, they can put out their own work and you can find it. So I know there's sort of a group of dietitians through Get Plantain, I think is the name. And they have like a diverse roster of dietitians, like a directory of dietitians. The same with Diversify Dietetics, which is a nonprofit. So you can just poke around there and start following people. And there is a pretty connected and active world on social media of dietitians who represent other cultures and are kind of trying to normalize the foods of their culture.
Yeah. I have been following Diversity Dietetics for a while, and it's introduced me to a lot of new people that I wouldn't have met, or, you know, wouldn't have been able to find. Mm-hmm. And then that the national conference just happened in Denver last week, where you are. And I was following them, and it was really interesting to see all the like smaller group conversations that this group of dietitians were having outside of like the main conference too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Interesting. I just wanted to, Oh gosh, I just had a question and it slipped away while you were talking. Briefly about this Washington Post article that of like dietitians being paid. This isn't completely on topic of what, but I think that it's an interesting topic of they were being paid by soda brands or sugar brands to talk about. Can you just talk about that issue? That was one of your last emails. About.
Yeah. Yeah. So, pretty much assume, I mean, if, I don't know, Renee, if you've experienced getting mail from big food companies as soon as you joined the academy.
I don't think so. I'm not noticing it. I don't know.
Yeah, it was pretty shocking for me because I just immediately started getting like things from the Dairy Council, like things from.
Yeah. You're right. Yes. Oh, yeah. I did get mailers on that. Yes.
Yeah. So it's just kind of interesting because. As an organization, the Academy of Nutrition and Dietetics, which is our professional organization, like has a very cozy relationship with big food and beverage corporations. And the sort of general attitude is like, it's not a problem. Like, it's fine. Without thinking about how like the sort of ethical and moral implications and kind of how it looks to have your message being paid for by the same corporations who are trying to sell food and drinks to Americans. So in this specific case, the Washington Post wrote an article about how social media, like dietitian influencers on social media are getting paid by organizations like the American Beverage Association, which represents Coke, Pepsi, and, you know, a ton of other soda and other beverage brands, or the Canadian Sugar Institute, to post on social media. For the American Beverage Association, it was specifically about aspartame because the WHO had just released a report calling aspartame possibly carcinogenic. So they wanted to push back on that. So the reporters at the Washington Post dug in to see how many people were actually fully disclosing A, that it was paid for, that their post was paid for, and B, who was paying for it. And they found that everyone disclosed that it was paid for, but very few people disclosed who was doing the paying. And so they just kind of break down if that was ethical or not. As I talked about in my post, they did it from a weird like diet culture perspective where it was just like, oh my God, the dietitian telling you it's okay to eat sugar. Isn't that weird and shocking? Which isn't shocking because a lot of dietitians do tell you it's okay to eat sugar. Like, don't restrict yourself. What the question is really like, is it okay for a dietitian to tell you to eat sugar and not tell you that she's being paid to tell you that by the Sugar Institute of Canada? Like, that's the bigger question that I think is not getting talked about because the tone of the article was unfortunately like very shaming, and other people, or I pointed out and other people have pointed out that it was strange that they really targeted these dietitians who, to be honest, like have zero amount of individual power to tell American Beverage Association, like, hey, you shouldn't be approaching these things in this way, and work in a field that is very underpaid and so need to find a way to survive. And instead, like instead of focusing on the systems and corporations that are creating this system of sponsorship, they instead decided to target these individual dietitians, which was strange. We don't really talk about in our education, we don't really talk about sort of what are the ethics of this, how might the food and beverage industry want to use us and our voices and our platforms as dietitians. The same way, you know, the pharmaceutical companies might want to use doctors to like push their products. And what is the line there, and how, especially for like a lot of younger dietitians who are the ones who are, you know, very active on social media, you might not have the experience yet or know how to kind of decide what the line is, around your values and what you want to stand for. So instead it's more like, well, I'm just not going to tell anyone, you know? And I think that does the like our profession a disservice, and it also does the public a disservice to not be fully transparent around that. So just a lot of sticky issues that I think haven't been confronted with. And at the same time, like, I appreciate the dietitians that are trying to destigmatize foods for people, because it doesn't help people if the only food store in your neighborhood is a corner store, and then you log on to social media and dietitians are telling you like, oh, you shouldn't eat this, it's overly processed, it's full of sugar and salt, when you have no other choice. So I appreciate that people are trying to destigmatize, like, yes, it's completely fine to make these individual choices based on your circumstances. But at the same time, we need to hold corporations accountable for, you know, kind of creating these food environments that don't support health for everyone.
Yeah. One of the, we briefly discussed this in class, this article in class, and looked at some of the handles of people that were, had been talking about it. I mean, it's difficult. It was difficult to have a nuanced conversation about this in class, I think, because people also are so young in this class. You're learning about, you know, you were older when you went to school. I'm in my mid 40s coming back to school. So we're just having a completely different experience. Like, we're bringing so much more to that conversation, but it was difficult. It was hard. It was hard to have that conversation. And I think another part of it is that when we're looking for information, when we're hurting, when we're in pain, and so we're looking at everything. And social media gives us a service, like we get all these different different types of conversations and perspectives, but it's overwhelming too, you know? And so we don't really know what is correct or what to trust. And mm-hmm. you see that paid, which I think we're probably starting to get used to seeing content with that paid of a normal, you know, everyday person having paid next on the top or the bottom of their caption. But it's so confusing. It's just, all of it is confusing. And then, you know, I was talking earlier today about we hold so many emotions attached to our food choices that come in from all over the place, that come in from our immediate family, from other media sources, from what we look like or don't look like, and what we've kind of held on to it. That I think following some of these dietitians that are really talking about the diversity in food choices and what's in cultural choices and what our bodies look like all over the globe is really helpful. But you kind of have to move around a little bit too.
And I'm hopeful that, like, that's a way in to kind of open up the field to other perspectives. But I think it's really hard until you've had that sort of awakening. It's really hard to understand it. So I can imagine what the conversation may have been like in your class, because I definitely did not feel those perspectives from, it was like very much against sort of the perception of, like, the food of Southeast Louisiana being, like, overly fatty, overly salty, just generally bad for you in every way.
Oh, okay. Interesting. Yeah. We've had, I mean, I don't know. Yeah. It is complicated. It's not easy. Even sitting, I mean, that's why before we started recording, I was like, okay, we could talk for hours and hours and hours on any of these issues. So, we're just kind of jumping a little bit. One thing I wanted to mention, I just thought about, have you ever listened to Maintenance Phase?
That podcast? Yes. Okay. Yeah.
They have a podcast about the origins of the food pyramid. Have you ever listened to that?
I think I did. Yeah.
It came out a few years ago, I think. It was really good, but it was about how they've had to change the food pyramid, which is now, like, called My Plate, which is a completely different way of looking visually at this, at what kind of fruits and vegetables you should be eating every day or throughout the week. And it was all about how the food pyramid changed, like what was on each section because of industry refusing, like putting all this pressure on the USDA at the time that they could not release it if milk was in this spot in the pyramid or if beef was in this spot. And
yeah, completely. I'm writing an article right now about the Mediterranean diet and talking about the Mediterranean diet pyramid. And looked up some old articles about it when it first came out. So this is like 1995. And it was super interesting because at that point in time, people were so against fat that they're like, well, it just has way too much fat. And I just don't believe that changing the type of fat you eat will have that much of an impact on your health. And they interviewed the president of the Academy, which was then the American Dietetic Association. And she was like, well, it just can't be healthy because there's no milk.
Right.
Just like already push. I mean, always just pushing the dairy always.
I know.
The Dairy Council. And I think it's just the dairy, but Dairy Council has like a lot of different arms. They employ a lot of dietitians and they're the number one sponsor of the Academy of Nutrition and Dietetics. Like they give them the most money.
I didn't realize that.
That's yeah.
I mean, this just, you know, I was born in the 1980. So I remember the milk, advertising campaign and stuff. And you're like, this is so weird. Why is this happening?
Yeah. I mean, it is weird. And it's also like she was saying, I can't imagine you would get enough calcium. Not thinking about like most of the world is lactose intolerant and does not drink milk. Like we're the weirdos for drinking milk and people manage to get their calcium in other ways.
Yeah. And also like spending some time I lived in Amsterdam and I lived in Budapest for a while in Krakow and the milk comes in like 2 ounces. Like literally it's like little, I was like, that can't be real. Like when I first saw all these milks and people were buying, like, it's like 2.5 ounces or maybe it's, I don't know, maybe it's a little bigger than that, but just teeny. It's really small. It's definitely less than a glass of milk that we would drink, you know, our family. But that also reminds me of like thinking about rice. Like, I feel like that is a conversation that's happening on social media a lot right now. Like, don't eat rice. Eat all the rice, all this stuff, and think about how, I mean, we grow rice here. Like we eat a lot of rice here, but so does a lot of the world, you know, and it's not that this specific food is causing us harm, you know, and I think that sometimes like the right diet looks like what a wealthier white family would want to eat or want to be seen eating, as opposed to like how communities over generations have been eating.
It just feels sometimes like we're so lost because we don't have that long history. Like when you're talking about rice, I'm just thinking about, I lived in Japan for a couple of years and people eat I'm half Thai, so I grew up eating a lot of rice, but like people in Japan eat a lot of rice, like with every meal, and it's white rice, it's not brown rice. And yet
that's another thing, yeah.
People have like one of the healthiest diets in the world, like the actual seven country study, which was the sort of basis for why the Mediterranean diet exploded. The Japanese diet, like the cohort that they studied of Japanese men were the third had the third lowest rates of like coronary heart disease. So it's an incredibly healthy diet and they eat tons and tons of white rice and it's fine. Like, and I don't think you would not see people in Japan being like, well, everyone just needs to stop eating rice because it's not healthy. Like it just wouldn't make any sense for their culture and history. And here in the US, like we just don't have that type of long history. Like in South Louisiana, you kind of do because there is a much more unique culinary cultural history. But in many places, it's just, we're so lost and just need someone to tell us the do's and don'ts because that makes us feel safe, I think.
Yeah, that's so interesting. I have never thought about not having, maybe because I'm Cajun, that isn't something that I really think about, that we don't have a long history of culinary, of, because in my family and in New Iberia, and that we do, mm-hmm. or longer, you know, not necessarily, but that's such an interesting perspective.
Yeah. And that's what I loved living there, and just having that, like coming from California, which is, you know, very diverse, like very diverse types of eating habits, but not really one or two shared long lasting culinary histories that people really felt proud of, like as on a regional level. So it was really cool to experience that just living in New Orleans and going to school out in the bayou.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I have, so kind of the only other things I wanted to make sure to talk to you about, I just wanted to get, so we have already kind of been talking on social determinants of health, and I'm actually doing an episode where I'm kind of explaining and talking about that later in the season. But I just wanted, maybe since that is also your background, if you could just explain what that concept is and like how that impacts us on a daily basis.
Yeah. So I think the popular perception of health is really, really simple and based on your individual choices, like what you choose to eat and how much you choose to exercise are really the two that people think, like whether or not you choose to smoke are kind of the big ones that people think about. When in reality, like our individual health is hugely determined by factors outside of our control. So that can include like whether, like your employment status, if you have a job or not, your education level, the kind of neighborhood that you live in. And it's very applicable to New Orleans because they have actually done studies that show that your zip code is correlated with the length of your life, with people in Lakeview having the longest life expectancy. And I think it was like maybe near the 7th ward. I can't remember which had the lowest, but it was definitely like the neighborhoods that were.
Yeah, I think it's my neighborhood. I think it's, I'm in 70113, and I think it's like in that
space. Yeah, so the neighborhoods that are just disproportionately Black and low income are the neighborhoods with the shortest life expectancy. And it's not because the people living there are all making bad choices. It's for all these other reasons that impact the health over the course of your life.
Even like the number of trees in the neighborhood, in the zip code made a difference.
Yeah.
That was part, tree cover was one piece of that, I think.
Yeah. I mean, even, and just thinking about New Orleans in particular, like, if you have functional sidewalks in your neighborhood, that can determine if you can walk places or not, you know, just simple things like that. And if you have no sidewalks and no tree cover, like, are you really going to be walking many places in the middle of summer? Probably not.
Yeah. Thank you. Thanks for explaining that. I forgot about that article on the zip codes. Mm-hmm. I'm going to put a lot of this in the show notes too, so people can just link on this. Cool. And then, so the last thing I want to talk about is, so now we know all these like very complicated situations, but we want to give, and a lot of people donate food here around hurricanes and all of those kinds of things, but also on a regular basis. Donating to mutual aid is really important. And so mutual aid is like more of a community-based, they're not organizations, or sometimes they're loosely organized people that have, we have a community fridge up the street, but New Orleans, does Denver have a lot of community fridges and that kind of stuff?
I'm not sure like how it compares to other places, but there are a few around town. Yeah.
What other suggestions do you have to help on this issue of like food and meal security and insecurity?
I think it's really important to think about how you can get involved to sort of strengthen the capacity of organizations wherever you live, especially BIPOC-led organizations. And that doesn't necessarily have to be explicitly related to food, because as we know, another social determinant is housing. And that's a huge issue for many people, because if you don't have affordable and safe housing, there's no way you're going to be able to feed yourself in a way that is easy and nourishing. So getting involved with organizations working for housing, or particularly in Louisiana, organizations like Vote that work with formerly incarcerated individuals, I think is important to just, because it's all just so interconnected, like poverty and the justice system and reproductive rights and all of these different issues are connected. So getting involved with those, not just in like a donating money basis, but if you're able to spend time and just being in community with people, I think is personally for me always really helpful to make me feel both that I'm working with others and but also just actually making a change. I was involved with the New Orleans Food Policy Action Committee, which if those are all over the place, I'm now involved with one here in Denver as well. So that's a great way to just see help on the ground. They're doing a lot of great local policy. I'm not sure if they're still working on a greener New Orleans, but that was the policy to make it easier for people to have like urban agriculture, because there were a lot of like small things in the local code that were making it difficult. So just paying attention to things like that, because often the small laws at the local level can have huge impacts, whether that's around like zoning or, in New Orleans, we were also working on something to keep, dollar stores from proliferating. So that can be helpful as well. We also worked on a campaign to try to make it easier for, small food entrepreneurs to be legally permitted. And of course, like that has a huge impact, especially on like Black owned small food businesses that just want to like go out and sell something during Mardi Gras or whatever. It was really not a clear process.
That has specifically ticked up in importance lately, because the nightmare has shut down most of the evening pop-ups on St. Paul. And in other places, so that people that do go out with their smokers in the evening to sell have all been shut down.
Mm.
Crazy.
I mean,
absolutely bananas.
Right. So just getting involved at the local level, I've found is really helpful to kind of push for change that you think will make for a more equitable food system and environment.
Yeah. And I think it's so interesting that all these topics that we've gone through today are things that dietitians can all play a part of. Like these aren't just, it isn't just like the one-on-one consultation for, you know, $500 an hour to discuss like one thing, right? Like these are how people who care about nutrition and food can be involved in all kinds of different topics.
It touches
so many parts of our society.
Yeah. And I rarely, like I'm in a lot of food justice spaces and I rarely meet other dietitians there, because I think a lot of people are like, I don't know what their reasoning is, but maybe they just don't know about it or they feel like that's not their lane. But the thing is, like as dietitians, as people with all this training, people respect our authority, whether or not we think we should have that role of expert or authority. And so that can be really helpful. Here in Denver, I was working on a policy change within the local schools to make it easier for lactose intolerant kids to request non-dairy milk. So, because that's something that disproportionately affects BIPOC students. Yeah. And the person who was leading the campaign was like, oh my God, you're a dietitian and a mother? Like, this is, you're like a unicorn.
The perfect spokesperson.
Yes. So I think we can sort of bring that authority with us into these spaces and open doors that other people might not be able to, even if it feels like, oh, I don't know enough. Like, I'm not that person to speak about food justice or anti-racism. Like, that's okay to just have your position and listen to others and then bring your sort of expertise that other people respect into the room is really helpful.
Thank you. That's awesome. Thank you so much. That's all I have for,
but all right.
I really appreciate your time and talking to me and talking to listeners all about
of course.
All.
Yeah, that was super fun.
That's all for today. Thanks so much for listening to Making Good. You can find our podcast on all the platforms you find your favorite podcasts. You can also find a transcript of this episode and all of our episodes on our website, churchalley.store. If you loved this episode, please share it and let others know about the good work of Church Alley Cafe and Grocery. Thanks again for listening to Making Good. I hope you have a really good day. We'll see you next time.